Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Welcome to this bonus episode of Sound Opinions. I'm Jim DeRogatis. My co-host is Greg Kot. But today we are turning the reins over to our producer, Andrew Gill. It's nice to have you on the air, Mr. Gill.
Hello, thanks for having me, guys.
So what do you got for us today?
Well, I recently interviewed the directors of a documentary about the singer Karen Dalton. Do you guys know who she is? You're familiar?
I did not know the name even until I started reading about this doc.
She's fairly obscure, but the people who know her, like people like Nick Cave and Dylan, they loved her. That second record, In My Own Time, I've actually been listening to that the last few weeks.
Yeah, because
I knew this movie was about to come out. It's great. Really great stuff. Holds up very well.
Yesterday, any way you made it was just
Yeah, it's very strange and haunting, and she had this way of being right on the cusp of, like, right on the edge of the picture, like with Dylan in Greenwich Village, and she almost was in the Mamas and the Papas.
Mm-hmm. A Zelig-like figure.
Yeah, but just never quite got through, and never, you know, she only made 2 albums. But this documentary was interesting, because so I got this press release. I'd never heard of her. And they have a picture of her with Dylan in Greenwich Village. And she looks like a spitting image of Angel Olsen. Like the short bangs and singing. And then I read that Angel Olsen read her diaries for the movie. She does the voice of Karen Dalton. So I was like, I got to watch this and see what's going on here. So it turns out it's a very sad story. It kind of leaves you seeing why feminism is very important. The challenges that women faced and that she faced were just terrible. Good movie to watch, very sad and sobering, but
worth our listeners' time.
Yeah, I think so. It's on streaming services. It opened in New York in October, but it's on streaming services as of last week. So,
well, we'll be back in a minute with more from the directors of the new film about Karen Dalton.
Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island. Since 1988, Goose Island's been brewing beers in the spirit of Chicago.
You can find IPAs, lemonade, shandy, and limited releases in-store or at one of Goose's venues in Chicago. Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer. Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island. Since 1988, Goose Island has been brewing award-winning beers in Chicago that are inspired by this city. Take 312 Lemonade Shandy, Tropical Beer Hug Double IPA, and a rotating series of hazy IPAs only available in Chicago. You know, every time we go down to Goose Island, there's another one that they're pushing on us.
That's right.
They're all good.
Absolutely. And what supporters of musical culture, you know, in the city of Chicago and elsewhere, if you go to a show in Chicago and you see that Goose Island sign, you know you're in good hands. They're music fans as well as great beer makers at Goose Island. So we're really proud to be associated with them.
The Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer. We're back with producer Andrew Gill.
Welcome to Sound Opinions, Rich Pete and Robert Yapkowitz, the co-directors of this film on Karen Dalton, In My Own Time. Very moving documentary. Welcome to Sound Opinions.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us and for watching the film.
Yeah, I have to admit, I didn't know Karen Dalton before I watched the film. Once I watched the movie, though, I started hearing her music all around, so, you know, like on TV shows and, you know, talking with friends who are into music, and they're like, oh yeah, Karen Dalton, she's great.
Are you leaving for the country? You say the city brings you down. Leave the iron behind and feel the circus moving on.
But it sounded like many of the people in the movie didn't think she was like worthy of the film treatment, almost. Like her daughter is in the movie quite a bit with a lot of very personal stories. And it's kind of amazing that you got her to share that, such an intimate, personal part of her life in this film. But can you talk about like how you had the idea to make a film about her and what it was like convincing people that she was worthy of, you know, the full-length documentary treatment?
Yeah, I think part of what you're picking up on is people's hesitancy to speak with us because other filmmakers had come before us trying to do films about Karen, and they had like volunteered their time and done interviews, and then nothing ever came of it. And a big part of that was just the lack of footage or audio pieces that these other filmmakers couldn't find. And so I think there's a little bit of frustration when it came to just talking about Karen. They were done telling these stories. You know, they were just sort of frustrated with that element of it. There's also, I think, people from that time period who were also musicians, they all want documentaries made on themselves. So we'd get like long tangents, or they're telling stories about their lives and they're like, cool, well, this one's about Karen, so let's come back to Karen and talk about her.
To recenter things a little bit, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think also like with Karen's daughter and some of her close friends, they were hesitant too, because I feel like it had been such a long time that Karen had been just on the fringe of kind of wider recognition. Every few years there would be like a reissue and then a couple articles, and then it would kind of fade back into the shadows again. And so I think, you know, to some of the people closest to Karen and her daughter, they didn't really think there was an audience in a way. Or they thought the audience was so limited that maybe it wouldn't be worth the time.
Right, you know? Right. So they were,
which is understandable.
They were protecting their own time investment in a way.
Yeah.
Well, why don't we start, since a lot of our listeners might not know the story of Karen Dalton. Let's start at the beginning. I mean, that she grew up in Oklahoma, you know, with an authentically folk upbringing, kind of, you know, right? Some of the people that she met later said, you know, she was one of the few authentic folk singers of the early 60s because she lived the life, you know? And yeah, it struck me that, you know, she was married at 15, had a kid, and then that marriage ended and married again by, I don't know how old she was with her second marriage, but had a daughter, and she was still, you know, early 20s or something, or younger, right? What was her life in Oklahoma like, as far as you gathered in making the film?
Karen's childhood was definitely something that was difficult to piece together. We were fortunate enough that we were able to speak with her brother and her cousin, who was pretty helpful with a couple of phone calls, but unfortunately passed away before we could interview her. Mm. So what we could gather is Karen's family was probably like, you know, lower middle class. She grew up in Enid, Oklahoma, which is a small town, in the late 30s, early 40s. The family was very conservative. They were very musical, but they were very conservative, and they were very involved in the church. They were Southern Baptists. And then her grandmother later converted to Methodist. And I think just the time and the place is played a big part into the authenticity that's often attributed to her. You know, Oklahoma in the early 40s, that's like the land of Woody Guthrie. You know what I mean? That's where people, that's where a lot of these songs that all these young people in Greenwich Village, all the songs they were covering, that's where the songs came from. That's where a lot of the songs were born. That on top of the whole Dust Bowl thing, you know, she kind of came in at the very tail end of the Dust Bowl and like really kind of lived through the residual effects of the Dust Bowl. So I think it's like all those factors play a big part into this authenticity that she kind of took with her for, you know,
it feels like too, like she, you know, she was born, like Rob said, into this, conservative family. She tried to fit within the box. She tried to marry, young and be like a housewife figure, which was, you know, what her parents did and, you know, what her peers were doing. And she just didn't fit within that box. And she grew up playing music, was an avid record collector, played at the church, played with her families. Like, that's what they would do, is get together and play music. One thing we could never figure out is just like, that's such a huge move, you know, when to leave her family behind, divorce her husband, and just take off and go to New York City. We were always so curious, like what was like the newspaper article or the radio piece that she heard that was exciting enough for her to leave her entire family behind and go to New York City to pursue this dream that she had, which, you know, was something we ultimately didn't find, but it was always just so exciting because it was something so profound that she was willing to do that.
Yeah, you never figured it out, right? Never
crack that case.
Yeah. Because that's really when it comes to life. Like, or it's almost like the stuff before, that's the prequel, you know. And then she really is birthed when she takes off and moves to New York City. Yeah,
right. That's when the transformation sort of begins, from the housewife in Oklahoma to, you know, the final Karen Dalton, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That character.
And it's kind of like she, you know, it's like, all right, I gave this the good old college try. You know, I did 2 years.
Totally.
I tried, you know, not wearing makeup and, you know, like kind of, maybe she was sinking into a depression or something, but she, you know, she tried to live in that kind of cage and then just couldn't do it. Right.
Yeah. And I feel like, you know, her story there, it's so relatable. Like, even myself, like I dropped out of college, I was living in my parents' basement and ended up like going to New York City for the first time as an adult and just meeting all of these like artists and being in Brooklyn and just being so blown away. It's just like, oh, this is where I have to be. Like, the energy of New York City is still alive. And I feel like it's, you know, something that both Rob and I can relate to, is just discovering New York and being so inspired.
The thing that I feel like sums her up the best to me is the Bob Dylan quote from his book Chronicles, where he said she sang like Billie Holiday and played guitar like Jimmy Reed, which is just so accurate. And then, you know, for other listeners in the current day, you know, a lot of Joanna Newsom in there as well. So, but yeah, talk about how she arrived in New York and how she just was rubbing shoulders with all these future stars.
Yeah. To go back, one thing we do know about her sort of trip to New York, we do know, though it's not in the movie, we know she went to Colorado for like 2 weeks.
Oh, really? Okay.
Before she went to New York.
Oh, wow.
And then she ended up traveling with people to New York. But according to her cousin, Patsy, who we spoke with, the end game was always to get to New York. Mm. That when she left, she was going to New York.
Because she ends up in Colorado again later. So those two places just had a big pull on her, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely.
We've talked a lot about just Karen's timing always being off, you know, it just like not always lining up right for her in her life. But there were a couple instances where she was right on. I think like her landing on the Greenwich Village scene was one of those cases where it was just like the perfect timing, and she just fit in so well there. It was like her people. She was, you know, everybody considered, she was a little bit older than some of the other people on the scene, and like people considered her like authentic folk. She had a very original voice. She could play the guitar And that was just an instance that she fit in very well. And I think, mm-hmm. you know, although people say it was like, you know, she had a tragic life, I think outside of the times when she was suffering from depression, I think she was like a very charismatic person and people were drawn to her. And that was something that she could take advantage of when she arrived to New York.
Yeah, I mean, that the story could have been much shorter. You know, she could have just shown up in New York and not met anybody and nobody cared and she went back to Oklahoma or something, you know, like.
Right, which is the case with a lot of people that went to Greenwich Village at that time.
Right,
it's,
yeah.
It's a common story.
It's kind of amazing. But I mean, and then she's there for a short period of time, right? But then there's another, you know, another aspect of being a woman in this time, like, kind of gives her, it's not a setback, I guess, but it like complicates her life in a way that these male musicians didn't really have to worry about. When she misses her daughter and just goes back and stages a kidnapping, essentially, right?
Yeah, I mean, she essentially goes back and tells her former husband that she wants to reconcile and moves back in with him and then puts her daughter in the car and drives to New York. But the way we kind of wanted to frame that story and I think the way you said it is pretty spot on. It's like she really just wanted to be with her daughter. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just, and like even her daughter says she doesn't, it never felt like a kidnapping. She's right. They were never like chased by police and she was a kid and she was just going with her mom.
Yeah.
But it's also that other thing where like, if Karen wants to do something, she's just going to do it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, at this point, there's a lot of people in the film that emphasize that she was very confident in her abilities, you know, and she knew that she was good. And like, I think Peter Stample from the Holy Motor Rounders says, you know, she just thought that her abilities were so self-evident that anybody with a brain should be able to see that she's great, you know. Yeah, and she did make a big impression, right, in Greenwich Village. It sounds like there was one person who said she hit the scene harder than Dylan did back then.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, she immediately, I think, really impressed some of the most influential people on that scene.
From that period, she was, you know, at the right place at the right time, as you said, Rich. Is there anything you attribute her to? Is there anything you attribute to the reason she didn't make a record at that time or end up, you know, getting swept up in that wave of folk that was breaking through?
I think it goes back to it kind of being a male-dominated scene and like what the people who were releasing records were looking for. If you were a female singer at that time, you had to have a certain image and kind of fit into a certain box. You had to be more like a Joan Baez or a Mary Travers, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. Or even, you know, there were other slightly more eccentric artists, but they weren't really as raw as Karen was. Like Hetty West, maybe, mm-hmm. you know, but even that, like, she has a pretty, her voice is very easy on the ears, Hetty West, and it's not, there's nothing outside, unconventional about what she's doing or the way she's doing it.
Because there's even a moment where she almost is in the Mamas and the Papas, right? She's like in the
essentially the in like a roundabout way. To that, yeah, right? Yeah, yeah, in a roundabout way. But then you like kind of listen to that band, even if you listen to it's the Journeymen was the predecessor to the Mamas and the Papas, with John Phillips and slowly the other members filtered in. But if you listen to that band, the Journeymen, and think about Karen fitting in there somewhere, it just doesn't, it seems impossible mm-hmm. in a way.
I don't know. It'd be cool to hear if they could have made something work. I bet it would be like a pretty exciting band if they were able to meld together and make something work.
Yeah.
I bet the dudes would have had to have much different attitudes, you know, to be able Absolutely. To like work with someone as, you know, confident and, you know, take no BS as Karen, you know. It seemed like she was not going to suffer fools or do what she's told, really. She wanted to be an equal partner, right?
Totally.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. It almost feels like Karen was surrounded by a bunch of men who wanted to tell her what to do. And they essentially thought she was insane for wanting to have an opinion on her own career and her own image.
Yeah.
It just seems wild when you think of it that way.
And it seems interesting, you know, watching the film, we're talking about feminism here, but we're three dudes, you know, talking about feminism.
I know. Like, yeah.
Did you seek counsel from women or did you think about
the
position of being a guy making this movie? And how did you work through your thoughts on that?
Well, we always wanted to make sure Karen had a voice. And, you know, we are talking about like feminism and her life as a mother. So we made sure to have producers and collaborators that are females. And we have a lot of close collaborators on this project that we're constantly watching and giving notes. We did screenings for big groups of friends and questionnaires and Q&As. And this is our first time ever making a feature film as directors. So it was a lot of trial and error for us in general. We didn't want Karen to be a tragic figure or people to constantly feel bad for her because she was like charismatic and a powerful person. So we hope that comes across in the film as well.
Well, yeah. And totally. And the other female voice that you hear probably the most is Angel Olsen reading Karen's journals and poetry. How did you come to that idea and how did you approach Angel to get involved?
It took a while. We were a lot of trial and error. We knew we wanted to give Karen a voice, but she's dead. So that's difficult. And, you know, we found those Bob Fast tapes. So we were very excited to incorporate those because those are the few times in the film where you're able to actually just hear her speaking, not singing, but knew we always wanted to incorporate the journals somehow. We tried quite a few different ways. And then ultimately when Vim Vendors came on as an EP on the film, he gave us a suggestion that was like something that was always in our brains, but it just took Vim Vendors saying it to be like, of course, that's what we have to do. And, you know, let's bring on somebody to read Karen's journals. And Angel, we knew, was a fan of Karen's and just had such a unique voice. And we asked her and she signed on and was perfect. We're so happy that she came on to work with us.
One thing, just going back to, you know, Karen being a female and us sort of navigating that, we just tried not to judge Karen in any way. Like the way we sort of portrayed, you know, some of the darker sides of her personality and things she struggled with, we just never wanted to judge her for any of her decisions. Mm-hmm. And hopefully that also comes across in the film.
So to pick up the timeline again, she leaves New York. And I'm not sure exactly why she left New York. Did you guys get a good reason why, or just wanted to head out to Colorado, or?
A combination of probably, you know, living in poverty, no money, no real resources. Like you can be one of the most popular musicians on the scene. If you're not, you know, Bob Dylan, 1964 famous, you're not making a lot of money playing basket houses where they take donations from the crowd. You know, you're making a couple bucks. Richard Tucker, her former husband, said, you know, that it was basically like, okay, we decide if we can pay for a cab home or eat a slice of pizza. It was what we did with our money at the end of the day. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And Abby talks about just living in these big houses with no heat. The toilet doesn't work. They have to go to the gas station across the street. Like, I think that, you know, her being a mother there too, she was just like, this isn't where I want to live. She liked Colorado. She loved being in nature. Karen was such a rambler. It was like, we did like a few versions of the film where we were trying to follow the chronology exact and like where she was. And then someone would tell us a story and like, oh, in 1964, I was hanging out with Karen in LA. We were roommates. And then someone else was like, oh yeah, in 64, Karen and I lived in Boston together.
Oh, my God.
where was she?
So we just had to ditch that because it felt like we were making things up at some point and just restructure the film.
We do lump things in like in our little Colorado segment of the film. You know, it's kind of a mixed bag of some people who knew her throughout her time in Colorado and stuff like that, but it works mostly chronologically. It's just kind of, you know, the nature of organizing the events of the life of someone who lived such a fragmented life, Karen.
Right.
It was also a fun time to explore, like Rob and I having grown up as adults in a time when there's like internet and social media, just the fact like Karen could disappear and just like be in Colorado and her friends wouldn't know where she was or how to contact her. And just like an exciting time to live that's pretty different from now.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Karen grew up in the country. She grew up riding horses. as her daughter says, hanging out at the rodeo grounds as a teenager. So Colorado is a natural transition. That's like, there's two sort of contrasting elements that play into each other in Karen's life. It's these two elements of her personality, which is this confidence and this strength, and then this sort of more vulnerable, fragile side. And I think that's sort of reflected in the landscapes too, like the geographic locations where it's like New York City. It's like her New York City side versus her Colorado side of her personality, constantly at odds with each other.
That's very insightful. I hadn't thought about that, but that really does kind of encompass a lot about, from what I gathered about Karen from the film, like there are those two, it's like there's two people going, you know, and...
Yeah, exactly. And she's constantly, they're constantly battling mm-hmm. those two aspects of her personality and her life are battling with each other. And that's a big part of the movie is like how those, I guess we kind of try to trace her from her early days and see how these sort of aspects of her personality came to be through certain stories and moments. And then sort of how these contrasting elements contributed to her work. You know, I think that's also, her music is raw, but intimate. She's delivers every line with confidence, but there's a looseness to it and sort of an element of it that feels very casual. So I think it's kind of all revolves around those elements of her personality, really.
Yeah, absolutely.
When I first came to town, they called me the Roving Jewel.
We'll be back in just a minute with more from Robert Yapkowitz and Richard Pete on Karen Dalton. Remember in 2018 when Border Patrol separated thousands of refugee kids from their parents, deported those parents back to their home countries, and kept the kids in the United States? Believe it or not, 6 years later, there are still hundreds of families who have not yet been reunited.
Though we as a community may feel hopeless at times, we recently learned about an organization called Al Otro Lado, which works to reunify families. They provide holistic legal and humanitarian support to refugees, deportees, and other migrants in the U.S. and Tijuana through a multidisciplinary, client-centered, harm-reduction-based practice.
Since 2018, they've reunited over 100 refugee families ripped apart by the zero-tolerance policy of the previous administration. Once reunited, Al Otro Lado helps each family find legal representation, housing, and the counseling they need in order to heal and get back on their feet.
Imagine having your child ripped from your arms and never knowing when you would see them again. We can't let family separations go on. If you're like us and believe that all families belong together, then join us supporting Al Otro Lado and donate today.
You can find the link to donate to Al Otro Lado in the description of this episode, or go to gum.fm/charity and donate today. That's gum.fm/charity.
You can also consider volunteering with the organization, which offers opportunities that are both in-person and virtual. The best way to get involved is by filling out an application on their website, elotrolado.org/volunteer.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
We're back with producer Andrew Gill.
Through the woods I'm going, through the boggy mire, straight way down.
In Colorado, though, she's hanging out with Tim Hardin a lot, and that's where it says she got into harder drugs for the first time, right?
Around the time in Colorado, they think Tim had come out from New York City. By the time Tim got out there, he had already released his first record, so he had things like Reason to Believe, which were, for him, mild hits. He had some success. He had already started using heroin at that time, and he went to Colorado, moved in right up the street from Karen and Richard to sort of kick heroin and just take some time away. He lived a pretty fast life himself. And there's some suspicion that, you know, he was on methadone there. And then that's kind of around the time in Colorado is when methadone and sort of speed started entering the picture in Karen's life and sort of circle of friends as well. It didn't escalate, you know, it escalated much. It became much worse later in life, obviously, but that's kind of the origins of it. And that was more of an experimentation thing. I don't think it really became this this thing that controlled her until later.
Yeah, it seemed like it was kind of a character in the wings, just sort of hanging around a little bit. And then she ends up back in New York.
She goes to New York to record the first album around 68, yeah. We think. End of 68 or so. That's where she makes the record with Capitol Records, produced by Nick Vinay, who before he had produced Fred Neil's records, but and then had done like the Beach Boys early records and some sort of like an old school record guy for sure.
If I should leave you, try to remember all the good times. Long days filled with sunshine and just a little bit of rain.
She had been playing some of those songs for 5-6 years. You know, a lot of those songs were her set or part of her set live. And she demoed and rehearsed for that record as well. There's has been some speculation in the past that she was tricked into recording, which is a lovely story. But from what the guitarist, Dan Hankin, who recorded on that album and played with Karen for many years, told us was that it was pretty planned out. And we've heard all the demos from, you know, she did a studio demo at Capitol Records with her and her guitar and two sets of demos at home for it all. Mostly all the same songs.
Yeah.
So she was prepared and ready to record those songs.
It doesn't get a lot of attention, it seems, right? The Village Voice had that great little write-up, but it was really not a full, you know, Village Voice critic's pick. It was just sort of a, what's wrong with you guys? It's been weeks and no one's talking
yeah,
about
it. Yeah, that's
this.
Exactly what the article says. It's like, hey, this has been out for a while and no one's talking about it.
Yeah.
What's up? With those types of albums, it's kind of like when you hear people talk about Dylan's first record. No one believed it would do much, but it was cheap to record and the producer wanted to do it. And I think it was the same thing with Karen's first record. Nick Vinay really loved her music and really wanted to record her. Probably a small group of musicians, didn't cost a lot of money, and they likely didn't put much money into advertising. Mm-hmm. You know, Karen played only shows in New York, basically surrounding it. She may have done one or two in LA a couple months later, but she didn't do a tour to support the album or anything like that. So it's hard. And it's also, like you said, like almost the most Karen Dalton record of her two records, which means it's generally pretty laid back as far as the pacing goes. Which also is tough for radio tunes at that time.
Yeah, I liked how you did in the film. You start showing some Woodstock footage, you know, just to set the scene of what 1969 was kind of about in the music world, and how Karen had kind of like taken too long to like really strike while the iron was hot on that folk explosion. And then, of course, Michael Lang comes into the scene, the impresario behind Woodstock, who is kind of unfairly given control of a record label. He signs Billy Joel first, of course, as you do.
Yeah, right.
The third signing is Karen Dalton.
When you think about that time period, too, it's like almost just right. I mean, you have bands like The Band, who... a little more rock and roll for sure, but aren't doing something so far off. And then not long after that album comes out, you really get the whole California, like Jackson Browne thing starts to happen. But still, Karen's not quite that.
Yeah.
She's just not.
The clips you found for her second album, which Michael Lang released in 1971, called In My Own Time, it seems like she's in the middle of something that's happening that doesn't really seem like... what her artistic vision was. And I don't know how much she was being like swept up by people telling her how it should be in the studio, or if that was where she was wanting to go, or if she just was releasing control or something.
I think she was sort of felt it was a good opportunity, and I think Karen gave it a go. Mm-hmm. Like, she kind of was like, realized that, you know, she might have to try a little bit here. And Michael Lang and Harvey Brooks put together the band. Karen liked the band. She liked playing with the band. She had done it in the late 60s for a little while. But it's definitely this type of thing where in those performances especially, you know, you can see there's a level of discomfort just being in front of a band. Mm-hmm. Like, when you see her in the black and white footage of her in the village with her guitar,
yeah,
in a smaller space, she seems so much more comfortable.
Yeah.
And when she's standing up there with a microphone in front of her, she just has her eyes closed and she doesn't seem really all that involved at all, mm-hmm, with anything, not even really with the musicians at certain points.
Right, right.
That was the most involved she ever really got in the industry,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
you know, and she was kind of dropped in the middle of the machine a bit and kind of just tried to hit the ground running, I think.
Yeah, and I mean, that was the year after Woodstock, the film made Michael Lang his money back, right?
So, yeah, yeah, exactly.
And so he must have been on top of the world at that point.
She got some money for the album. Like, it was probably more money than Karen had ever had in her entire life up until that,
mm-hmm,
point.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even know what the number is, but I'm sure it was, you know, several thousand dollars.
Yeah.
And she was up in Woodstock. She was recording at a brand new studio that Bob Dylan's manager just opened, Albert Grossman's studio. Mm-hmm. She was hanging with the band. She was hanging with Tim Hardin, who was living in a huge mansion. Like, I think it was the mansion of the Heinz Ketchup.
Oh, wow.
Heiress or something like that, you know, like the Heinz Ketchup fortune.
Mm-hmm.
So I think in her mind, she was kind of like on top of the world a little bit. Like, she had her children with her. She was, I think she was feeling good early on in Woodstock, and you know, then I think slowly but surely, things changed for sure.
It's openings for, of all people, Santana. Could you imagine a scenario where that went well?
No, it's difficult,
yeah.
But like, you know, Rich said when we were talking to someone else about this, that it's kind of like, if, you know, Mike Lang was trying to do an admirable thing there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he really did love her music. And like, he loved Tim Hardin's music. He loved Richie Havens. He was really into that kind of those people that came off that scene,
yeah,
the Greenwich Village scene. And, you know, it is wild because Santana was such an energetic band. It was like the polar opposite of Karen. But if it had went well and Karen shot Karen to superstardom, everyone would be like, Mike Lang's a genius.
Right, yeah.
You know,
yeah,
it's just kind of, he tried, it didn't work. The odds were stacked against them, for sure.
Yeah. It reminds me of like, there's that story about Jimi Hendrix opening for the Monkees. You know, like that's a
yeah, exactly,
good mismatch as well. Let's see, I think Robert, I think you're frozen up. Am I doing okay?
Oh, yeah, I'm frozen
okay,
again.
All right. I can hear you though, fine, right? That's all cool. Right. I just want to make sure we're not going to drop off or lose connection.
Yeah, I just have to.
Well, let's see. It's not long after this record and that Santana tour that most of her friends say they saw her for the last time, it seems. You know, like, early 70s, right? Peter Stampfl tells these stories about Karen being there with the Rounders recording and just, you know, just shooting up. And it seems at that point the drugs kind of step onto the main stage from the wings a little bit.
Yeah, they were wild. I mean, their period together that you're referring to is like early to mid 70s, really kind of picked up in the mid 70s, like those late Rounders albums. And they were wild at that time. I mean, they were all just off the rails.
Yes, everybody. It wasn't just Karen. Like, they
yeah,
were
of course. Not, yeah, not
that whole group of people. Yeah. There were like 10 people in the Holy Modal Rounders at that time, you know,
right.
and all their significant others and partners and pals. They had like a gang of like 20 people, 25 people that they were just, you know, staying up for days and playing music.
Yeah. When did Karen lose touch with most of these music friends and like what precipitated that?
I think the early 70s, she kind of separated herself from certain people on the scene. She still maintained, I know, a bit of a relationship with Harvey Brooks until about 1975. When she moved off into the Rounders scene, because the Rounders had always kind of separated themselves. It was like the Holy Modal Rounders and like the Fugs. And they were like the weirdos in the early days. And they were like very involved in the scene, but also had their own sort of little avenue, their own little back alley on that scene where they all hung out. So in the middle 70s, when Karen started getting in more in the Rounders, she sort of separated herself more from the mainstream music scene and the mainstream, like the music culture and industry and all of that. And then by the end of the 70s, I think she was pretty much out of touch with most of her friends from the industry and the scene. It all happened in the 70s, basically. After the second album is slowly but surely things, she just sort of separated herself from that world altogether.
Yeah.
And then we just play at dive bars.
Right, okay.
There's a small scene up in Woodstock too, like her and Peter Walker, that she would like play little shows up there, but or just kind of like together, they would kind of play. And she was writing a lot of poetry and keeping her journals and eventually like sold her guitars. But yeah, it seemed like a pretty quiet life up in Woodstock there the last days out. Her son Lee ended up living with her for a little bit up there.
Okay, that was from her first marriage when she was 15. Yeah.
She maintained contact with certain people. I know she was in touch with Tim Hardin until he died, which I think was 1980 or 1979. 1980, I believe. She was very sporadically in touch with Fred Neil still.
And then eventually, sadly, she contracted AIDS. Did you have to figure that out through, you know, investigating or...
It was kind of known that she contracted AIDS. Some of her friends weren't totally aware of it. Some people had heard throat cancer, but it was AIDS related. You know, even though she lived a quiet life later in life, both that Woodstock scene and her friends in New York, obviously, they were just still involved in drugs and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Even at Woodstock in the 80s, they were staying up all night hanging out still with Peter. Peter will even talk about it sometimes. They had a small crew up there.
Yeah. Then she dies in 93, is that right?
Yeah, 1993 is when she passed away.
And then how long was it until people started reappraising her music and like bringing it back to the front of people's consciousness?
The reason we like started the documentary is that her peers were on the jukebox at this bar we were at in Brooklyn, and we were just bummed that Karen wasn't. And that was like 6 years ago. I feel like just within like the past like 6 years or so, you start hearing Karen like at restaurants. Rob and I were just on a shoot in California, and Karen was playing in the hotel lobby.
In Monterey, California. It wasn't even LA. It was like Monterey.
Yeah, I heard her on that show, The Pursuit of Love.
Something on Your Mind shows up a lot on these Netflix series, too. I've noticed it in showing up in like five or six shows.
What do you take away from Karen Dalton's life and music, and what do you hope viewers of the film take away?
There's a lot of misinformation about her out in the world, and this is an opportunity for existing fans to get a glimpse into her life and hear her journals, see new footage. And then for people that have never heard of Karen, the goal is to create some new fans and hopefully for somebody to get excited about her music and feel like they're discovering somebody new in their life.
I mean, you know, also it's like worth saying, you know, this type of music and music in general is just a part of our history as a culture. And Karen has a place in that history for sure. She's got, you know, one foot in the past and sort of these traditional values. And then she had one foot in the future. She's almost kind of, in a way, bridged the gap between this sort of traditional music and sort of slightly more unconventional music, almost in the same way the Holy Modal Rounders did. She was just a little more subtle. In the way she did it. But, you know, she's like a good bridge between folk and these new sort of indie folk artists and stuff like that.
Yeah.
The takeaway from the way she navigated her career is also a good example for the way that modern musicians have done it. A lot of modern musicians prefer to record on their own terms and tour on their own terms and have the luxury of being able to do that when, of course, Karen at that time did not.
If only Karen had the internet.
Yeah, right, yeah, exactly. The democratization of the music industry would have helped her a lot, right?
When are you leaving for the country? You say the city brings you down.
Thank you, Rich and Robert, for making this film and for talking with us on Sound Opinions, being generous with your time.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah,
a pleasure.
Thanks, Andrew. It's very nice talking to you. Yeah, we appreciate it.
Wow, illuminating conversation about the underappreciated Karen Dalton and the new film about her. That's it for this bonus episode. If you've got thoughts on this episode, start a conversation in our Facebook group or leave a voice message on our website, soundopinions.org.
As always, Sound Opinions is produced by Andrew Gill, Alex Claiborne, our associate producer, Sol Delgadillo, and our intern, Mary Bernthal. Our social media consultant is Katie Cott. Thanks for listening.